It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Tackling the controversies, engaging the culture, challenging the status quo, and taking your calls. Dr. Brown is the director of Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Call now at 866-34-TRUTH and get into the line of fire.
Hey friends, I'm going to do something today on the line of fire that I've never done before. After, I don't know how many hundreds of broadcasts, I want to share with you in more depth my testimony and glorify the Lord. I won't be taking calls, devoting the entire show to sharing this with you, so sit back, enjoy the program. But if you know a Jewish person that is seeking or is curious about Jesus, give him a call or shoot him a note. Tell him to tune in. Maybe you've got a young person listening or a friend that's away from the Lord, and you think this would be great to have them tune in and listen. Hey, if God saved me, and if he's using me, he can save and use anybody. If you'd like to interact with me, the simplest way to do it is just join our Facebook fan page, AskDr Brown, Ask Dr. Brown, or always through our website, AskDrBrown.org. In fact, if you'll go there, AskDrBrown.org, and click on the line of fire, you will see a link to today's program where you can watch a video of my testimony as I shared this at a church. And hopefully a video where we reenacted some things. Well, I didn't quite reenact all of it. Went back to some of the places and shared firsthand. So we'll have some links where you can find out more about my testimony from LSD to PhD. Now, look, my PhD is 25 years back, so this is not the central part of my life. But it's a good catchy thing, and it's a way I can reach out to others. I printed a track many years ago called From LSD to PhD with a picture of me before I was saved. Picture me with my hair growing long and my rebellious drug-using days. And my hair got longer, I got more rebellious, but I didn't know I was going to get saved and have a testimony. So that's the best, worst picture I could find, if you follow me. In fact, when I showed it to my wife, Nancy, years after we were married, knew each other, I found this old picture and showed it to her. And she started laughing. I said, "You're laughing because I look like a woman in that picture." And she said, "No, I'm laughing because you look like an ugly woman." So if you go to the website, check out the testimonies where you can actually watch. You will see that picture. And trust me, you won't argue with her. All right. My personal testimony. What a joy to glorify the Lord. I was born in New York City, 1955. That means in the year 2010, I turned 55. I haven't been born in 55. My dad was the senior law assistant in the New York Supreme Court. Before he retired and died suddenly right after that, he was almost promoted to being a judge in the New York Supreme Court. And as the senior law assistant, it meant he was the key man that as decisions were being rendered by the judges, the material would go to the law assistants. And as lawyers, they would research things. My dad had a lot of recall, knew the cases, came back very quickly. And they would write out the decisions. And many well-known decisions in my dad's day that were under the name of different judges, my dad actually wrote. He would tell me about how he was going to rule on a particular thing. And then the judges thought so highly of his work, often they just signed their name to his decision. Senior law assistant, New York Supreme Court. And born in New York City, I was. And after almost 7 years, we moved to Long Island. My mom and dad were very happily married. When you hear that I got into drugs and rebellion, you might think, well, what was wrong in the family? I had a great family upbringing. Boy, you couldn't be more affirmed than I was affirmed as a boy, Jewish boy growing up. My older sister, 3.5 years older than me. We grew up with loving parents and a loving environment and typical Long Island conservative Jews. You say, what does that mean? Maybe you grew up nominally Catholic, nominally Presbyterian, nominally Methodist. Maybe there were rites like a baptismal rite for a baby, maybe confirmation. Maybe you went to church, Easter, Christmas, something like that. Well, it's very similar to what I grew up with in the synagogue. You know, there's circumcision when you're 8 days old. Of course, you don't remember that as a little boy. But then started to go to synagogue a little bit when it was closer to my bar mitzvah time. I went to Hebrew school to learn enough Hebrew to chant the portion of scripture that I had to be familiar with. I didn't know what it was. didn't know what the text said in translation, but I had to learn to chant it for my bar mitzvah when I turned 13. We would go to the synagogue on the high holy days, but I was not a religious Jew. I knew this, though. We didn't believe in Jesus. We're Jews. I mean, you had us and them. And them, I don't mean this in a hostile way, because I went to school in a mixed school. The community I grew up with, grew up in about 300 families, the great majority of them Jewish, almost all of them Jewish, right over the bridge. I mean, it's this little bridge you'd walk over going to school, almost all Gentile. And we went to school together. Everybody's friends. There's no hostility, no Jew-Gentile kind of separation that I remembered in any negative way. But still, in terms of beliefs, there was us and them. That's how many Jewish people think. And to me, them was Gentiles, Catholics, Protestants, Christians, which in my mind were all the same. Do you understand? If you weren't Jewish, you were Gentile, which meant Protestant, Catholic, Christian. They were all bungled together in my mind. So I'm 13 years old. I get bar mitzvahed, but something else happened when I was 13 years old. It's 1968. I had been playing drums since I was 8. My sister and I started playing organ when we were little. I was 5 1/2. I guess she was 8 1/2, 9. We started to play. But then when I was 8, I got a drum, a snare drum. I started banging on the drum. I was just somehow liked it, was interested in it, and was far better playing drums than playing organ. And remember 1964, that's when the Beatles come to America, rock music, these new things coming in. I'm having private lessons. I'm doing very well with my drum teacher. I'm interested in these other forms of music, not just jazz and things, but now rock music. I'm 13 years old, and I go to see a concert. It was in the New York Philharmonic, and it was the Jimi Hendrix Experience. Jimi Hendrix, Noel Redding, Mitch Mitchell. That was his band. And boy, I wanted to be like them. The power of the music. I mean, it's blaringly loud music. The power of their persona. I mean, each of them just dressed in this wild hippie outfits and the long hair, the afros, and everything being so different. I wanted to be in a rock band so badly. I played with friends here and there in my neighborhood, you know, music, but I wanted to be in a rock band, and I wanted to be like the rock stars. So I got more and more into the whole rock music scene. And you have to realize, this was happening in the 60s. The 60s is the time of counterculture revolution in America. The 60s is a time after the war years, after World War II, families now getting built up again, all the babies being born in the post-war era, the kids growing up, and you have a disproportionately high number of young people in society at that time, which sociologists have told me is the basic ingredient for revolution. Because young people want to break the rules, and young people want to fight, and young people don't want to go along with the system. So after the stability of the Eisenhower years, the post-war years, the 60s had a lot of times of shaking. You know, birth control pill came out in 1960. You aware of that? 1960, who even noticed it? But now you could separate sex from procreation. You could have recreational sex much more easily and freely. Give you an idea of what American culture was like, though. 1961, the Academy Award-winning movie was what? You remember? What was the Academy Award-winning movie for 1961? It was West Side Story. West Side Story was considered controversial because of all the violence. Go out and watch West Side Story if you have an opportunity. It's a musical. They've got dance scenes. You've got gangs wearing jackets and ties dancing on the streets of New York. And the violence compared to a violent movie today is absolutely infinitesimal. That's what culture was like. Things shifting, changing a little bit. We're now in the early stages as the 60s go on of the Vietnam War, which becomes massively unpopular, much, much more unpopular than the Iraq and Afghanistan wars today. Much more socially divisive. And we had draft then, so your number may come up, and you're on your way off to Vietnam to fight a war that we didn't know why we were fighting. That's how it seemed. And then, it's a positive thing, civil rights movement, stirring. 1963, Martin Luther King gives his famous I Have a Dream speech at the great rally in D.C., and wow, this nonviolent movement, it's catching on. It's challenging the status quo in a good sense. A lot of other things happening that are shaking our country. 1963 is when John F. Kennedy is assassinated. If you were alive then, you remember where you were. I remember being in school, and the announcement comes, and kids start crying, and we're going to be going home from school now. School's canceled, and you watch on TV later, and the camera's just, the cameraman just go, you know, what happens? This camera swings, and the fear, the shock. This is now in your living room. We have black and white TV. This is in your living room. This is all new upheaval. 1964, as I said, the Beatles come to America. New sounds, new way of living, new way of thinking begins to challenge the status quo. And before you know it, we have taken place in America a massive generation gap. We have taken place in America sexual revolution. We have taken place a massive cultural shift. I got caught up in the counterculture 60s. I'm going to tell you what happened to me as I share my testimony today on The Line of Fire. Remember to go to AskDrBrown.org. Click on The Line of Fire for more relevant links to my testimony. Thanks for joining us today on The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, glad to be with you. Not taking calls today, but I am sharing at length my personal testimony from LSD to PhD. I trust it will encourage you, bless you. As I said, if God could save and use me, he could save and use anybody. We've got some links, video links that tie in with my testimony. So if you go to AskDrBrown.org, click on The Line of Fire, you can watch some of these links that I think will bless you and encourage you. And you can share them with your friends as well. So I was explaining right before the break how it is that a nice Jewish kid, just typical kid, going to school, coming home, playing sports with his friends after school, how at the age of 14, as you'll find out in a moment, I started doing drugs. I started getting high, raised by a loving mom and dad, a good moral upbringing on Long Island, not in the inner city, not surrounded by heavy drug use, but I got caught up in the counterculture 60s. Hey, look, just give you a picture. Someone pointed out if you fell asleep in the year 1960 and woke up in the year 2000, you'd wake up to the divorce rate doubled, teen suicide up 3 times, reported violent crime up 4 times, prison population up 5 times, children born out of wedlock up 6 times, people living together out of wedlock up 7 times. And most of the shift happened in a very quick period of time from the mid-60s into the early 70s, and I was caught up with that, playing drums in a band with my friends, rock music, going to see the concerts. For those that live back then and know the names, or younger people that have heard the groups, you know, The Who performing rock opera Tommy, I saw them. Jimi Hendrix, saw him twice. Jim Morrison and The Doors, saw them. Janis Joplin, saw her. I mean, band after band. Led Zeppelin, saw 4 times. Jethro Tull, saw 4 times. Band after band. I just lived to be at these concerts. Jefferson Airplane and the psychedelic groups and the whole bit. And they got high. They did drugs. Almost all these bands were known for drug use or psychedelic kind of thinking. And so it got me interested. So I'm 14 years old. I'm not seeking deeper issues in life. I'm not looking for answers. This 14-year-old kid, hedonistic, just wanting to do what I want to do and enjoy myself, flesh-loving. Someone offers me pot. You want to get high? Yeah, well, why? I mean, I'd like to try it. I mean, my heroes do it, the drummer, the rock drummers and the musicians and the, you know, these guys with the long hair and the psychedelic-looking clothing, the far-out stuff. Yeah, I'd like to try getting high. Why not? So I smoke pot. Nothing happens to me. Nothing. Now, you'd think, okay, put well your head. Now, here's the funny thing. I've never had a cup of coffee in my entire life. 55 years old, I've never had a cup of coffee in my life. No, I'm not interested in trying and developing some new addiction or habit, okay? Never had a cup of coffee. As a kid, I enjoyed coffee candy. I'd still enjoy coffee candy to this day, but I took a sip of coffee. I didn't like it, and I never touched it again. I have never smoked a cigarette in my life. That's right. I've never smoked a cigarette. I puffed on a cigarette with some friends as a kid, as a teenager. Didn't like it. Never tried it again. And yet, when it came to getting high, I smoked pot. Nothing happened, and I thought, well, I wonder why. I remember some policemen came to our junior high school, maybe call it middle school today. They came to our junior high school, and they gave a presentation, and they explained how if you start with marijuana, it'll then proceed to heroin. And I thought, how stupid. These guys don't know anything. What jerks. I mean, I was an arrogant kid, and the generation gap was really starting to get into my thinking, the disrespect for the older generation, the disrespect for authority. These are guys, these are policemen who work in dealing with drug users, and I'm sitting there saying they don't know anything. Well, the sad thing is that's the exact path I took. Because I'm saying, no, pot, that leads to like other things, LSD, that's like one category, like the hippie drugs, and then there's the junkie drugs. I didn't necessarily have the savvy to understand it in that detail then, but that is how I looked at it. Like, you got to be stupid. Well, they actually described exactly what happened to me. Smoke pot, nothing happened. Well, I'm with some friends, and they're smoking hashish. Oh, this is like pot, but stronger. I'll try that. Everybody's in the room getting very high. I smoke it. Nothing happens. I smoked enough for something to happen, but nothing happened. Something about my body was a little bit different. That's how I ended up with the nicknames Drug Bear and Iron Man. If you're just tuning in, sharing my testimony on the broadcast today from LSD to PhD. If you'd like to watch it in more detail, video as I share it, or go to AskDrBrown.org and click on the Line of Fire today's show, you'll see the links. I was called Drug Bear and Iron Man because ultimately I was able to put more drugs into my system than anybody in my school. What a stupid thing to boast about, but I was stupid. You know, I was destroying myself, but I was proud of it because I could put more destructive stuff in my body than anybody else in my school. So something just about me, it took more for me to get high. That means that instead of stopping while I was ahead, I quickly went to harder drugs. I quickly started using ups and downs. What did my parents think? They didn't know about it. They're not going to think their nice son is doing drugs. What, you know, most parents are not going to realize what's really happening. And I knew how to put up the front that everything was fine. And, you know, my dad was liberal and thought probably one day marijuana will actually be legalized. And when he found out I was smoking pot, he didn't flip out as much as other parents would have. And it was more like, if you're going to do it, don't do much, do it in the house. So he was very liberal. But they didn't know I was doing these other things and started using LSD. Boy, that changes your perspective. These mind-bending drugs, we thought they were consciousness expanding. And you see what was happening in the 60s, parallel to the sexual revolution, parallel to the influx of rock music and the sounds of rebellion, parallel to all the drugs, parallel to the upheaval in society. Because, you know, by 68, the assassination of Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy, revolutionary movements around the world, the whole nation shaking, convulsing. That's where you have 1969, Woodstock, 1969, the Stonewall riots, the beginning of gay liberation movement. During this time, you've got radical feminism rising. All these things happening in the society at the same time, this time of real shaking and upheaval. But there is also a strong spiritual move, where spirituality was in. No, established religion was no good. Established religion was no good. But, this is the way we would think, but spirituality was very cool. And Eastern religion, mysticism, these things, wow, very interesting. Of course, the Beatles got into Eastern religion. So we would get high, listen to rock music, and talk about spiritual things endlessly. Then, at the age of 15... something very dramatic happened to me, even more life-destroying. And you've heard of divine appointments, you know, where God sets something up and you say, wow, this was a divine appointment for me to meet someone in a certain place, certain time, certain situation. I had what can only be called a devilish, demonic, satanic appointment that almost destroyed my life. I'll tell you about that on the other side of the break. Stay with us. Well, Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast. Michael Brown, I share my personal testimony with you today. I realize that in hundreds of broadcasts I've made reference to it, but never took the time to share it in full. I was praying about some shows to do this week and felt this was a good thing to share and that you'd be encouraged by it as you hear the mercy of God and his divine intervention. So I won't be taking calls, but you can talk to me via Facebook at Ask Dr. Brown on our Facebook page, or if you go to AskDrBrown.org, our website, not only are there hundreds of hours of free resources there in our online bookstore, but also links to the Line of Fire for today with some video links that tie in with my testimony as well. All right, so Jewish kid, Long Island, start getting high at the age of 14, part of my rock drumming culture, part of the rebellion of the 60s that I got caught up with. You know, there's this saying, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there, and if you were there, then you understand the saying. If not, don't worry about it. 15 years old now. I'm a heavy drug user already, but I'd made a determination. And please, every young person listening, hear me carefully. Every older person listening, your standards are starting to get adjusted. You're starting to live differently than you did before. Please hear me carefully. When I started getting high, I knew that there were harder drugs. I'd heard about speed, amphetamine, methadone. I heard about heroin. Cocaine was just starting to come in. I heard about these drugs. I knew there were people who put a needle in their arms. I would never do that. There's no way I would do that. I mean, smoking pot, even using LSD, that was one thing. But the other stuff, no way. That was like low life. That was like some guy living in a cardboard box in a inner city somewhere, stealing from old ladies. Not me. So I determined that whatever drugs I do, I'll stop at a certain point. Well, I was offered speed. Why don't you try snorting speed? I did that. Wow, what an experience. I mean, instant euphoria, and the world's a better place, and you're so happy, and wow, this is amazing, and you're playing drums faster than you played before, at least sounds like that in your mind, and wow. Of course, couldn't stand it forever, but I hung out with some guys and they shot it. I thought, I'll never put a needle in my arm. It wasn't long after that I was putting a needle in my arm, but I was quite determined. I will never shoot heroin. I mean, that's really bad. That's really addictive. I will never shoot heroin. And then I was shooting heroin. Can I remind you, friend, that it's a very slippery slope when it comes to opening the door to sin? Maybe you're flirting with someone online, but you'd never go further. You probably will. Probably will. If you don't catch it, repent now. Probably will. Experimenting with some things that you know are wrong, but you won't go further. Probably will. You've already gone too far. You've already opened yourself up to other powers. You've already taken yourself out from obedience to God. You've already crossed lines that you probably would have told me 6 months or a year ago you never would have crossed. Now's the time to wake up to reality and to say, oh, God, help me before I destroy my life. I'm 15 years old now. I'm riding on the bus, obviously too young to drive. The high school I went to was about a 20, 25-minute bus ride away, and I hung out with friends there often. So I take the bus into a place called West Hempstead. Grew up in Island Park, Long Island, right next to Long Beach. And I'm on the bus, and I happen to be the only white person on the bus. Everyone else on the bus is black. So my hair's grown long at this point. I've got the hippie look. A guy says to me, total stranger, black man says to me, do you know where I can get some mescaline? He may have said cop mescaline, whatever the drug word we used was. You know, right? Cop some mescaline. This African-American man, I don't know, says this to me. Well, it just so happened. I said before the break, you heard a divine appointment. This was a satanic appointment. This was set up from hell. It just so happened that I had mescaline on me. Now, I assume most of you don't have a drug background, but this was not a usual drug to have, especially to have this powdered form that I had in my pocket as I was traveling of a very high grade. Do you know, he says to me, where I can cop some mescaline? Well, could he be a narcotics agent? I'm stupid enough. Just say, yeah, I've got some on me. Well, I'm interested in heroin now. I'm ready to cross that line, but I don't know where to get it. I said to him, you know where I cop some smack, meaning heroin? He says, yeah, I got some on me. You gotta be kidding me. Yeah, that, friends, the devil's at work too, to seduce and destroy. And he may set some things up that are the perfect fall for us if we play games with sin. Oh, can I urge you, friend? Don't play games. You're always going to lose when you play games with sin. So we, right in full view of people on this bus, they're looking at us with, you know, big eyes, like, what are you guys doing? We take out tin foil with this white powder. We carve out a certain amount, fold it again in tin foil, hand it to each other. How much do I do? Do all of it. Now, at this point, I'm shooting speed and I'm shooting other drugs, anything. And if I was addicted to the needle, I would try to make everything shootable and shoot it in my veins. That's how stupid I was. I got off the bus. I was all excited. I ran home. I don't know, 3/4 of a mile to my house. I ran home. I'm going to shoot heroin for the first time. And I did it. And no, you don't get instantly addicted. I thought that's what happens. No, you don't get instantly addicted. And with my high resistance, I never got around to being addicted to heroin because after 5 days, it cost me so much to get high, I just switched off to another drug. I was more addicted to the needle. But now, a 15-year-old Jewish kid raised in a nice home with a loving mom and dad, my dad, the senior lawyer working in the New York Supreme Court, I'm shooting heroin. How in the world? And not only that, we're doing even sicker, crazy things. We'd go to these trucks that were parked in this desolate parking lot behind the railroad tracks in the town where I grew up. And we'd screw off unscrew the gas cap, and we would inhale until we found really potent smelling diesel gas, and we huffed diesel gas. We would get high on drugs and then huff diesel gas. You talk about just drinking in, sniffing in, taking in destruction into your body and brain. That's what we did. Now think of this. Think of the amazing grace and goodness of God. Are you ready? Think of this, friends. God looks down. He wants to raise up somebody to debate the rabbis. He wants to raise up somebody that'll write a series of apologetics books answering long-term Jewish objections to Jesus that haven't been answered for generations. So what does he do? He looks down and sees this utter jerk huffing diesel gas, shooting drugs into his veins, full of rebellion, full of the devil, and says, I got just the person. Friends, do you understand that God chooses the foolish things of the world to confound the wise? Do you understand he chooses the weak things to bring down the mighty? Do you understand that he works through human beings like you and me so that he gets the glory, so that we can't mistakenly think it's me, I'm the one, I did it? Oh boy, thank God for his mercy and grace, sparing me from death. When we come back, I'm going to share how God brought me to himself out of the haze, out of the rebellion, out of the filth of my life. The mercy of God prevailed, and God saved this Jew through the blood of Jesus. Stay with us. Hey friends, Michael Brown here, sharing my personal testimony with you from LSD to PhD. You know, I was going to give more of what happened after I was saved. I've ended up talking about more my descent into sin, perhaps as warnings to others, perhaps as an encouragement to others that God can save from anywhere. Not taking calls, but you can reach me through AskDrBrown.org, through our website, click contact, or on our Facebook page, Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown on Facebook. All right, I'm now 16 years old. I am famous in my school among my peers for my ridiculous drug use. Drug bear, Iron Man, they call me. I'm a good drummer for my age. I played on a studio album when I was 15 years old, playing different types of musical genres for some dance album. Full of pride, full of rebellion. And God starts working on my two best friends. they were raised respectively Methodist and Russian Orthodox, but had no clue about who Jesus was. We're no more saved than I was saved. We were partners in drugs together. We were partners in crime. We, bass player and I, the fellow band member, we broke into a doctor's office one time, actually stole different drugs, then next day threw back through the hole in the window the drugs we weren't going to use. I mean, just stupid, but we were moral sinners, right? Stole adrenaline, mainlined adrenaline. Anyone that's listening, doctor, medical professional, we almost killed ourselves doing that. Broke into some houses, just stupid things. God starts working in their hearts. They were friends with two girls in the local high school. And these two girls had a dad who had been praying for them all their lives. The mother was not saved. The dad was saved. They got saved shortly after they got married. Praying for his daughters to come to the Lord. Their uncle was the pastor, this little Italian Pentecostal church. They were Italian family. And God started to draw the girls in. And my friends wanted to hang out with the girls they liked, started to go to the services. And they got interested in the services. No, it wasn't the music. They didn't have loud music like our rock music. In fact, they had basically a piano player who played the old hymns. They had a good beat to her, you know, good style to her. It was a piano player playing the old hymns. You know, how much of a beat is there to make me a blessing or blessed assurance? But the church taught a lot about prophecy, so that interested us. And as stupid as it seems, what I'm telling you is no exaggeration. End time prophecies, the book of Revelation, there's, you know, and beast coming out of the bottomless pit with seven heads and ten horns. That's the type of stuff we hallucinated on drugs. So this is like, wow. Really cool. And the church was Pentecostal, so they believed in God healing the sick, and there were stories in years past of demons leaving people. And so my friends would say, man, is this really cool church, and start to talk to me about these weird stories. And we were all interested, fascinating. But then God started to change the girls, and God started to change my friends. God started to convict them of sin. And now they were preaching the gospel to me. I didn't want to hear it. So August of 1971, I decide that's it. I'm 16 years old. I'm going to go to this stupid church. I completely judged everybody arrogantly. And maybe 40, 50 people would be there in a midweek service, little place. And I'm going to pull my friends out because I cannot argue anybody. I'm going to prove that they're wrong. And so I go to the service. And these older folks greeted me, some in their 60s, just so nice, sweet, greeted me. I found out afterwards some began to pray for me from that day. Ooh, and God began to convict me of sin. I didn't know that people were going to be praying. The end of the service, the pastor says, there's someone here, and if you don't get right with God tonight, that's it. It's your last chance. And I figured they obviously think it's me. I'm the real bad guy. Everybody knows about it. It's obviously me. You know, I'm kind of laughing. I don't take it seriously. Well, my friend's next to me. He nudges me, and he says, hey, I'll raise my hand if you raise yours. I thought, fine. Let him go first. If it's not him, it'd be me, and I'll play along with this silly thing. He raised his hand. The pastor goes, that's the one. I figure that out. Anyway, I decide, you know, they're nice people, very nice people. They have their way. I have mine. That's it. I'm going my own way. A few weeks later, I'm offered hallucinogenic drugs. It's been given out at a park where I hang out. I am offered as much as I want. People were dipping their fingers in this powdered drug and taking two finger lips licks, the real shy ones, and up to 10, the real bold ones. I took two handfuls. I took enough hallucinogenic drugs for 30 people, the equivalent of an ounce of mescaline, and for the first time, couldn't handle it. For the first time, had no idea what was going on, what my bearings were, I didn't know where I was. And my friends put me on the bus to go home, thinking this is so funny, he's finally taken too much. This is my reputation, drug bear, Iron Man, I can do anything. Get on the bus. At a certain point, I look up, everybody's staring at me on the bus. It's Labor Day weekend. I think, I don't know what's going on. And I figure I must have been delirious. Hang on. I'll be back. Finish the story when we come back. All right, boy, I have been sharing my personal testimony this show. And I'm almost out of time, so I've got to get to the glorious transformation, and maybe I'll continue this another day. All right, so here's what happens now. I am 16 years old. I've had the gospel preached to me. I'm in rebellion. I'm heavily using drugs, the heaviest drug use in my high school in terms of just quantity of drugs I would use. Almost destroyed myself over and over again and thought it was just funny. I've taken the equivalent of an ounce of mescaline. I have no idea what's going on. My friends put me on a bus to go home completely high on this hallucinogenic drug. I get off a few stops early because I'm in a panic. I think, oh no, I'm near the stop I'm supposed to get out, but I don't know where I am. I'm in a complete panic. This is Labor Day weekend of 1971. And I by the way, if you want to watch the testimony on video, go to askdrbrown.org and click on Line of Fire, and then you'll see the video links for today. Okay, so I get off this bus. I'm walking home. I'm going around this turn. I think I'm never going to come out of this turn. I must be in hell. It's over. I'm tormented. I'm going crazy. I can't take this. And I'm a block and a half from my house. A block and a half from my house. And I can't take it anymore. My friends have been preaching to me, you know, in these months past. I think this is it. I'm in hell. I sit down on the front lawn. It's like 1 in the morning. Front lawn of a family. I grew up for years playing ball with the son of this family here. It's like 1 in the morning. At the top of my lungs, I'm screaming out, I'm burning in hell. I'm roasting in hell. Yes, yours truly. Dr. Michael Brown. As I said in the previous broadcast, God saves people like me and uses people like me to demonstrate that anything good that comes out of us is for his glory and for his credit and for his honor. A guy comes walking by. A neighbor. I knew who he was, but I didn't remember his name. I'd gone to his son's bar mitzvah. I knew it was some Jewish name, so I said, hi, Mr. Goldstein. He's walking his dog. And I think to myself, why is he walking his dog in hell? And he looks at me, he's stunned. He walks on, and I continue to cry out, I'm burning in hell, I'm roasting in hell. I finally thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to do like they do in the movies. I'm going to end it. I am going to jump in front of the next car that comes by. And you say, but you already thought you were in hell. How are you going to end it? Look, I was not logically consistent, okay? My brain was fried from drugs. I was not logically consistent. So here's what happens. Car. I see car headlights. Car is coming around the corner. Some bushes on the side of the house, the side of the yard, so I can't quite see, but I see a car is coming. I see it's turning to come down the street. I'm right on the corner. I jump in front of the car. I throw my hands up, and it comes to a screeching halt, just inches away from me. It was my parents. Yeah, it was my parents. This neighbor had seen what had happened, terrified, went over, woke my parents up in the middle of the night. And they came looking for me. I was so delirious. My parents said, we're going to take you to the hospital. I just didn't care. They bring me home. I'm delirious in my room talking to myself. They pack me in the car. They bring me to the emergency room. I was so ugly towards my dad, just all the junk that was in my life. And I get in the hospital. Now I thought I'd been captured by the enemy. And I'm not going to betray the cause. I'm not going to tell anybody what happened there. Trying to write, you know, what drug did you take? I'm not telling. Finally, my dad gets hold of my friends. They're hysterical. They think this is just so, so funny. They're telling drugs I used. I get shot to sleep through the night, get home. Day after that, wow, my band's playing in front of the school. I have something new to boast about. Okay, listen, friends, I didn't do it on purpose like this, but just more telling the lostness out of which God saved me. We come back tomorrow. I'm going to finish my testimony. Glorify the Lord. There's more to come, trust me.